Next case of the morning, St. Paul versus Viking. Mr. Marone. Well, wait a minute, just so everybody gets cleared out here. Okay, go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. Anthony Marone on behalf of St. Paul Mercury Insurance. This matter comes before you following the entry of summary judgment on behalf of Viking and against my client, St. Paul Mercury Insurance. At the trial court level, the trial court dismissed the tort and warranty claims asserted against Viking, where we sought damages for damages arising out of the failure of the Viking product. There's no doubt in this case we're seeking economic damages. And according to the court in their ruling on the motion for summary judgment, the two theories available on a product liability claim in Wisconsin are, one, a tort claim, but we're not allowed to pursue those because our damages are economic in nature. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court has already indicated that under the economic loss doctrine, those damages are not recoverable by us. The second avenue of recovery is through the warranty. Johnson Bank had this building built for them. They utilized a fire suppression system that featured the Viking products. The Viking sprinkler head was purchased by Johnson Bank through the installer. Johnson paid for the products and then had them installed in their building. The trial court indicated that that was not sufficient connection, sufficient privity for a warranty claim to stand. This court should reverse that because Johnson Bank, as the expected intended user and purchaser of the Viking product, is entitled to the protections of the warranty that comes with the product.
Now, St. Paul didn't file a separate suit against Mortenson, did it?
They did not.
Why not? Isn't that the party that should have been sued, that St. Paul should have sued, or at least brought in?
It is one party that had that there could have been a viable theory against. The problem with that is, and there's been no dispute in the record, that the installation of this product, there was nothing wrong with it. The way the product was installed, there was nothing wrong with it. That's even conceded by Viking's own people. The issue with the product is with the product itself. When this matter goes to trial, assuming that the court reverses, we'll be able to deduce testimony and establish, and you can, for purposes of today, assume that to be true, that there's a defect in the product. If you look at in Wisconsin, there's a clear public policy where a manufacturer of a defective product should be held accountable for the damages caused by their product. In this case, Mortenson didn't do anything wrong. The problem is with the product itself. And to get to the public policy, the clearly public stated policy in Wisconsin, we would have to pursue first Mortenson, who would then have to third party in the installer, who then have to fourth party in the product manufacturer. Whereas the most direct route, the most economic route, the most efficient route would be to be able to pursue directly the warranty that comes with the product, especially in light of the fact that Johnson Bank is the expected and intended user of this product. If you look at it, there's two ways you can come to this conclusion. The first is through an agency theory. At the time the product was purchased, at the time it was installed, the installer was doing that at the behest of Johnson Bank. They satisfy the test for agency. And Wisconsin has long held, dating back to 1914, that when a middleman purchases materials for a principal, the warranties and the contract that is entered into by the middleman with the supplier are binding on the principal. And in this case, that is true even if it's undisclosed. So dating back to 1914, the relationship that Johnson Bank had with its installer would satisfy the agency relationship. And by virtue of that agency relationship, they also are entitled to the benefits and protections that come with the warranty on the Viking product. The second prong to the argument is that there's a discussion of privity and what that actually means under Wisconsin law. Wisconsin talks in many ways that in order to maintain a warranty action, you have to have privity. But it does very little in the course of its history defining what that is, what actually does qualify as privity. And if you look at the evolution of the product liability law in Wisconsin, especially over the last 30 years, there has been a dramatic shift. The first pronouncement's always been constant, that a manufacturer of a product that causes damage should be responsible for those damages. The way they did that has changed over time. Originally, it was a tort theory. You always had a tort theory available. Even if you were in the direct nexus, direct connection, there may not have been a contract theory, but you're always given a tort theory. That changed in 1989 in Sunnyslope when they adopted the economic loss doctrine. Since adopting the economic loss doctrine, that doctrine has gained speed in terms of its application. Even in this case, from the point when we filed suit until the hearing, I believe there was something along the lines of 5 to 6 different cases coming down that expanded the economic loss doctrine. I think that the pronouncement and what you're getting from the Wisconsin Supreme Court is they don't want to see where there is a contract in place for purchase of goods, such as in this case, it's not a tort claim, it's a contractual claim.
What you're saying, I guess, is that this chain reaction that you described before about the contractor, subcontractor, manufacturer, as you go down the line, you eventually get to a point where there is privity between the two parties. And so you're saying, I guess, that there's the case law coming down where you can bypass all of that and go directly and assert whatever the last contract was.
I believe so. I think that if you look at the Danning case and analyze it in the grand scheme of things, especially the way it reverses to the extent that it is against the holding in City of La Crosse, that is exactly what the Wisconsin Supreme Court has said.
Then why shouldn't we wait until the Wisconsin court eliminates whatever privity requirement remains in the context of this case before we do?
I think if you, in reading the Danning decision, it has said, and I think the status of Wisconsin law has actually reached that point. There hasn't been a case such as this one that allows them to make that specific pronouncement, but all the chips are there, and I think in terms of the way the Danning case reads, Wisconsin law is already there. Wisconsin law, I mean, especially if you look at the way it plays out and juxtaposes against the City of La Crosse case, you have a viable theory. You have in the City of La Crosse, they said you can't pursue a contract claim, you can pursue a tort claim. Still holding, though, that you had a viable theory. Dannon still supports the idea that you should have a viable theory. It's just how you get there. I think the one relevant and critical part of the inquiry as well is in Dan, and they cite to the Michigan case and Sullivan Industries, and they talk about the fact that privity in analyzing the situation and the juxtaposition between the warranty and the economic loss claims really doesn't have much of a place anymore in the modern context. And I think it's significant that they cite to a Michigan case where in that Sullivan case they discuss the fact that privity is no longer required to pursue, or at least vertical privity is no longer required to pursue a warranty claim where you are an expected intended user in the vertical stream of commerce against the original manufacturer of the product. This is not a case where the product was sold to Johnson Bank, who then used it and turned around and sold it to another entity where there would be instead of vertical horizontal privity. There is a direct connection between Johnson Bank and Viking. And Viking, to some extent, acknowledged that at the time of the loss where they sent information out to them saying, here's what we require in order for us to examine your case under our warranty provisions. They didn't say you don't have a warranty. They said this is what we require you to do in order to have us consider it. And then they ultimately decided internally, there's communication at the Viking facility where they said, we don't think this damage is necessarily related to a product defect. They never say that this isn't because of there's no warranty. That only came up during the course of the litigation that argument manifested itself. But to answer your question, I think the state of Wisconsin law is already there.
Although, like you said, they haven't made such a ruling in the factual scenario that we have.
That is correct. Yeah. That is correct. But I think this court has the ability to say that those chips are there. And, you know, the other alternative would be to certify it.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to ask you next. I mean, certainly you would prefer certifying to affirming.
Absolutely. I would prefer even more that reversing the trial court's decision, but that is an option available to this panel for sure.
Because there's no guarantee. I mean, I know how you're looking at that Dannon case and the evolution, but there's no guarantee that the Wisconsin's. I mean, obviously we have to read the tea leaves based on the evolution of the cases, but there's no guarantee they would rule the way you've suggested.
That is correct, although I do think, as you say, that mm-hmm. the tea leaves are there. I see that I'm cutting into my rebuttal time. The only thing I would like to, with regards to the issue presented in the second issue, I think that's been fairly well briefed, and I would St. Paul Mercury would stand on their issue on the brief with regards to the Daubert issue. Obviously, the more critical issue is because of its dispositive nature is the warranty. But in light of our conversation here today, I think there is ample evidence to say that the law in Wisconsin would allow and permit and provide that there is a direct connection between Johnson Bank that would allow them to enforce a warranty that they had as the expected intended user of the product. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Michael Branson.
May it please the court, Mr. Maroney. My name is Lars Gulbranson. I represent the Viking Corporation. I guess I first want to address some of the points that Mr. Maroney made. I disagree with his interpretation of where Wisconsin law is with regard to the requirement that parties who sue for a breach of warranty actually have some contractual relationship between them. I also disagree that there's any direct connection between Viking and Johnson Bank. These two parties were foreign to each other. There's throughout the briefs and Mr. Maroney just argued that that Johnson Bank paid for the sprinklers. Well, there's no evidence in the record that Johnson Bank directly did anything with Viking. They certainly didn't directly pay Viking for the sprinklers. There isn't even evidence in this record of what warranty St. Paul is suing to enforce. That warranty did not pass from Viking to Johnson Bank.
But let's just assume, just for so we can get it clear, suppose everything were done correctly installed, everything is in place, and for some unknown reason, and maybe some expert could determine, the thing did not work. It wasn't effective. It did break. It did go off earlier. It went off for no good reason and did do a lot of property damage. Who would have a claim, if anyone?
Well, Johnson Bank had a claim against Mortenson.
I'm talking about Viking.
Who would have?
You say it'd have to go through that whole chain, as he described.
It would have had to go through the chain, and okay. And it's the same as any product.
So the subcontractor would have a claim then.
Exactly.
And after somebody made a claim against him.
And the warranty on its face says that this warranty applies to only the immediate purchaser, and that was Wenninger,
the
subcontractor. This isn't unlike if you bought a computer from Dell, and you were convinced that the microprocessor in the computer was bad, and you decided instead of suing Dell to sue Intel. Well, that's not how it works. You sue the party, or you make a. You don't even need to sue. I mean, you start by making a claim on the warranty. You make a claim on the warranty to the party that you bought the product from. This was essentially a component part of the whole that Johnson Bank bought. And that whole was the building. Back to the discussion about Wisconsin law and where Wisconsin law is moving and the Dannon case, I think it's important to look at the policy, the Wisconsin public policy that's set forth very clearly in the Dannon case, and that's the policy that Wisconsin has adopted as its reason for going forward with the economic loss doctrine and continuing to develop the economic loss doctrine. And the policy as stated in Dannon, is to maintain the fundamental distinction between tort law and contract law, to protect commercial parties' freedom to allocate economic risk by contract, and to encourage the party best situated to assess the risk of economic loss, the commercial purchaser, to assume, allocate, or insure against that risk. Now, here that played out. The commercial purchaser, Johnson Bank, actually allocated the risk to the party it purchased the building from, Mortenson, and it insured against the risk. This is how an efficient system of respecting contract law works. It's also efficient because allowing Viking to limit its liability, to limit the warranty it gives on its product, allows Viking to be able to assess what risk it has. What is its known risk of loss? We can control the amount of risk we have on selling these sprinklers, and then we can sell the sprinkler at a reasonable price because the risk of loss is known. That's the way respecting contract relationships work, and that's why we have this system where in order to enforce a contract, you actually have to have a contract. What St. Paul is asking the court to do here is to create a contract when there was no relationship between Viking and Johnson Bank. The relationship went from Johnson Bank, who purchased a building, a completed building, ordered and paid for a completed building from its contractor, Mortenson. Mortenson gave Johnson Bank a warranty on that building. Mortenson hired subcontractors who Johnson Bank had no relationship with. There's no evidence in the record that Johnson Bank ever had any contact with Wenninger. And Wenninger was the subcontractor that installed the fire suppression system. Wenninger gave a warranty to Mortenson. Wenninger, as the installer of the subcontractor, went out and bought the component parts, the sprinkler, for instance, that it put into the building. Each of those parties was able to limit its liability in contract, and that provides for an efficient economic system and an economic system in which parties are free to limit their risk through contract. And that's an important policy argument, or an important policy, and it's the policy that stands behind Wisconsin's adoption of the economic loss doctrine. To say in this case, even though there was no relationship between Viking and Johnson Bank, we're going to create a contract or find that a contract did exist, that would erode that policy, that would erode the ability of parties to be able to limit their risk through contract, and it would allow parties to make an end run around their contracts, and it would essentially neuter the economic loss doctrine. What point would there be to having a doctrine that restricts parties to suing on the contracts they actually have and saying, well, these are contractual damages. You should have allocated your risk. You should have planned for the risk in your contract. Your contract should speak to this damage. What good would that policy be if you didn't have to respect that contract? If you could just sue further on down the line, you could sue a party that you didn't have any contract with. That wouldn't make any sense. The economic loss doctrine would be meaningless at that point. I'm going to briefly address the privity argument, the agency argument that St. Paul also makes. Their first argument, I guess, is that they were a party to the contract because Wenninger was their agent, and therefore they stand in the shoes of Wenninger's contractual relationship with Viking. The main problem with their argument, and there are several problems with the argument, but the main problem is there's just no evidence in the record to support it, and that's why the court below granted summary judgment. There's no evidence of any relationship with Wenninger. There's no evidence of an agency agreement with Wenninger. St. Paul didn't even allege in its complaint that Wenninger was an agent. when in discovery St. Paul was asked by Viking for all contracts between Viking and Johnson Bank, the answer was, we don't have any. Johnson Bank contracted, or sorry, Viking contracted, or Wenninger purchased the sprinkler. So there are no contracts between Johnson Bank and Viking. And that was a correct statement at the time. The first time we heard the agency argument was in response to our summary judgment motion. Under Rule 56, St. Paul, as the party opposing summary judgment, can't just stand on their bare allegations or their bare argument and say to the court, well, Wenninger was a subcontractor who was working on this building that was ultimately owned by Johnson Bank, so they were the agent of Johnson Bank. It doesn't work that way. They need to set forth some specific facts. They need to cite something in the record that says they meet the elements of agency law that they would be required to prove under Wisconsin law. Finally, I'll address the Daubert motion, the motion to strike. The court below properly denied the motion to strike. I think from the record, Your Honors can see that Judge Callahan correctly applied the Daubert factors. So the review of Judge Callahan's decision would be a abuse of discretion review. There's no abuse of discretion. There was a factual record to support that Dr. Gland's work was reliable. The methodology he relied upon were tried and true methods of photomicroscopy. He's a surface chemist. He has a PhD. And he has professional experience using the photomicroscopy techniques he used to compare the two sprinklers. He compared the sprinkler with an exemplar sprinkler and the specifications for a sprinkler. He found that there was no manufacturing defect, and he also found witness marks that he thought could have contributed to the activation of the sprinkler. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Maroney?
With regards to the points raised by opposing counsel there, Viking has taken the position that the freedom of contract outweighs the public policy considerations, longstanding in Wisconsin, that a product manufacturer should be responsible for damages caused by the defective products. Counsel's argument, I think, displays the limitations of that position. According to Viking, Viking limits its warranty to the first person that purchases it, which we do claim is by virtue of the agency relationship, Johnson Bank. But if you assume for a second that their position is correct and that the purchaser and the person entitled to this warranty is the installer is virtually never going to have a warranty claim to make. Because when the product fails, the product is not going to fail in its warehouse. It's going to fail in its actual application, which will never take place within the control and property of the installer. So in essence, what Viking is saying is that they want to limit their warranty to the point where they have no risk, and they want to have no responsibility for the damages caused by their product's failure. That is in complete defiance of Wisconsin's public policy regarding the manufacturers and product safety. In terms of walking through the distributive chain to get to them, it simply doesn't make sense to do it that way, and I don't think Wisconsin wants it to be done that way in light of the fact that they are turning towards warranty and walking away from tort in order to pursue these claims. The idea that there should be a complaint and a third-party complaint, a fourth-party complaint, there would be other situations you'd have fifth- and sixth-party complaints just to get to the ultimate party who's actually responsible.
What would you call this, the type of a complaint? Would this be something, strict liability or something? What would it be, where you go directly to the ultimate?
Well, it's a warranty claim.
It's not strict liability. It's not a torque-based theory.
So then it's based on some period of time or whatever the warranty was in the first place.
Correct. Absolutely. And that does provide them with the ability to protect themselves and gauge their risk. What they're seeking to do here today is actually have no risk, to contract away all potential liability, which simply is not proper. It's not in keeping with the standards set forth by Wisconsin in terms of protecting their own citizenry. In terms of talking about the agency relationship, take issue again with the idea that there's no agency here. There clearly is. The trial court ruled that in their order they acknowledged that that Johnson Bank paid for these goods. They paid for these goods through although the actual purchase was made by the installer. That's still a direct enough connection that establishes through the agency relationship that there is a purchase there that also gives you the benefits and protections of a warranty. And I think it's consistent with Wisconsin law across the board in terms of the Wisconsin lien statute that we cite in our brief. If, for whatever reason, the installer chose not to pay Viking for these goods, Viking would have a lien on the property that Johnson Bank owns. Viking would have a lien on that building. Viking would have the right to try to recoup from Johnson Bank for those goods. Why does it not then follow that, by the same token, the purchaser of those goods, the entity that's paying for those goods, would not have a warranty claim or have the protections that come with paying for the good? That simply doesn't make sense.
Because you can't put a lien on anybody else. So you put a lien on the ultimate product that encompasses the product, the whatever is owed. I mean, that's an interesting argument, but there's certainly a distinction between a lien and other claims.
I understand what the court is saying, and I think it goes both ways. If you have a right to recoup payment, the party that is paying for it and actually receiving the benefit of those goods, assuming that the product actually works, would also have the rights and protection that come with the product that's being purchased.
Mm-hmm.
With regards to...
Your time's up here.
Oh, so I apologize. May I just
finish up
briefly? We do believe that in light of the arguments that we've set forth in our brief and that you've heard here today, that there is ample evidence to establish that, one, there is an agency relationship, and, two, that there is sufficient privity between Johnson Bank and the Viking Corporation in order for the Johnson Bank to have a viable, enforceable warranty, that being as the expected intended user of the Viking product. So we would ask that the court reverse the trial court's decision on that issue.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. Case will be taken under advisement.